Now, the business that we're all here for. Our first case today is 21-2035, Carmazzi Global Solutions versus the Commissioner of Social Security. Mr. Kernan?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Please proceed.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, the appellant asks that this Court remedy an injustice that occurred procedurally in the Board of Contract Appeals on the two matters you have before you today. We're taking up matters 2021-2035 and 2022-1231. The facts in these two cases are interrelated, and the facts are similar in the two cases and impact the issues before the Court today.
But could you start with telling us what the separate issues are before you start talking about them?
Yes, Your Honor. In 2022-1231, the Court granted a motion for summary judgment under Rule 56, under the standards of Rule 56. No discovery was propounded by the appellant in the matter because the case was in bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy trustee and bankruptcy attorney had control of the case as an asset of the bankruptcy, so the appellant had no control of the case and no ability to conduct discovery. Despite conducting no discovery, ability to conduct no discovery in the matter, the Board granted the motion for summary judgment in 2035.
And that involves 15 out of 18 contracts that are in dispute here?
Yes, Your Honor. The case involves verbatim video transcripts for Social Security Administration hearings. There's 18 different contracts. The first case, 2021-2035, deals with three representative cases that the Board took up first as a representative of what might happen with all the 18 cases. In that matter, the case was docketed before the Board of Contract Appeals, and once the case began, the company went into bankruptcy. At that point, the bankruptcy trustee and bankruptcy attorney took over the case as an asset of the bankruptcy. The bankruptcy attorney had full control of the case, but did nothing with respect to discovery in the matter.
But the fact is, this appeal was filed late.
You're referring to with this Court, Your Honor?
Yes.
Is our position that it was filed timely within 120 days with respect to the jurisdictional issue? The appeal was filed with the board, similar to what
the statute says it has to be filed with this Court.
The statute itself, the procedural rules of this Court indicate that it should be filed with this Court, but jurisdictionally under the statute, it's our position that it says 120 days, but it doesn't require specific filing with the Court of Federal Claims or Court of Appeals to the Federal Circuit.
Well, I mean, you have to agree that the statute, in order to bestow jurisdiction upon us, that says it has to be filed within 120 days, it has to be filed on us. I think I understand your argument to be that courts have generally allowed for sort of something akin to a transfer when a filing has been inadvertently filed in the wrong tribunal within what would be the correct time period. You treat it as though it were correctly filed. Is that an accurate statement of what you're asking the Court to consider?
Yes, Your Honor. Similar to under the Federal Rules Appellate Procedure 4D, where if it's filed with the appellate court, it should have been filed with the district court. The court forwards the appeal to the district court for processing. There's no adverse effects on the process in this case.
Yeah, but I mean, the standard is what? Excusable neglect? For your having filed in the wrong place?
Yes, Your Honor. Excusable neglect or it actually was filed properly, just not within the proper procedures. Timely, but not with the proper procedures.
So what makes this case excusable? I mean, we have pro se filings. We have different various excuses. It doesn't seem to me that there's any excuse here other than somebody didn't read the rules accurately enough.
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that the filing was timely. The procedure for the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit isn't jurisdictional, so the Court, under the Supreme Court decision in Foeman, says that mere technicality should not be a basis for dismissing an appeal and not hearing it on the merits.
Respectfully, I don't know how you can argue that your filing was timely. your filing is non-compliant. There's a difference between whether you timely filed and whether we are forced to dismiss because you untimely filed. What is your argument that you timely filed?
That we filed within 120 days with the board as a timely filing, similar to as if you would file with the Court of Federal Claims.
Yes, but Rule 4D only applies to filings in federal court. It applies to district court filings that will be treated as having been filed in the appellate courts. Right?
It's our position that's analogous to this situation where you have a filing that was done with a court that gives full notice to everyone that the appeal is filed. So there's no indication that to the parties that there wasn't proper appeal.
Where did you actually file the case?
With the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals.
Right, so you didn't file it in court. You didn't even file it in Article III Tribunal. The Rule 4C deals with when one filing is in the wrong Article III court, treating it as though it was in the correct Article III court. You filed it with something that's not even an Article III court, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So would you have us extend this rule to just anything if you filed it at the post office? If you filed it with the VA, which is just an agency? Is your argument that any place it is filed within the federal government should count for jurisdictional purposes as an Article III court?
No, our argument is that we filed with the Board of Contract Appeals where all the parties were notified that.
But it's not an Article III tribunal.
But our argument would be that there's no stipulation that has to be filed with an Article III tribunal, as long as we did file, everyone was notified within that 120 days that the appeal was filed. There's nothing in the rules that stipulates it has to be an Article III tribunal. It's not like filing with any office within the government. It was filed with the Board of Contract Appeals where there's a requirement that all the parties are notified. There's a requirement that...
But you could make the same... If you filed it with the VA, not even a court, just with the VA, but you also served process on all the parties, couldn't you stand here and make the identical argument you're making now, that failure to file in any court at all should be forgiven because the parties all received notice?
It was the court, applicable court, for the case on the merits, number one. And number two, there is a requirement within the rules of that particular court that the parties be notified, so unlike just filing anywhere and serving process, randomly. There is a specific rule within the court that the case was before that the parties be notified.
Remind me how you found out that you had erred. I mean, did the board tell you?
No, the Court of Federal Claims, Court of Appeals of Federal Circuit notified prior counsel. With respect to the...
Is there any explanation at all for why it wasn't filed in the right place?
My understanding is that it was filed, because prior cases had been filed that were appealed from the Court of Federal Claims, the process in the Court of Federal Claims is to file with the Court of Federal Claims first and not with the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Similarly, the belief was that to file with the board and the same process would apply. With respect to the decision, the summary judgment decision below, our position is that it was a manifest injustice to not allow the appellant to conduct discoveries on this matter after the case was returned to the appellant when the bankruptcy trustee abandoned the case. At that point, no discovery had been conducted. There was no opposition to the motion for summary judgment. We asked for the court to vacate the decision, allow us to discovery, and that request was denied in the two paragraphs.
Am I confusing this with another case? I thought because discovery started in February of 2019, I thought discovery did commence.
Yeah, but there was no counsel for it other than the bankruptcy trustee at that point who had control of the case. Social Security Administration conducted discovery, but there was no discovery conducted by the appellant, the bankruptcy trustee.
Weren't there four depositions taken from SSA by SSA employees?
By SSA, correct. Discovery was conducted by the government, but not by the appellant. The appellant was represented.
Why?
And it was defended it was defended by the trustee attorney, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But he chose to conduct no discovery, and then 6 days. Yes, Your Honor.
You have a representative who represents your interests. Like in this case, you weren't actually the lawyer that made any of these mistakes, were you?
No, Your Honor.
Right. So you come in and represent them now, and you're making the best arguments you can for their position, but why aren't they held responsible for the actions of the prior representative, in this case, the trustee? The trustee could have engaged in discovery, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
The trustee had the ability to do so, in fact, possibly even the obligation to do so, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was their representative at the time in the litigation.
Our position is that they weren't the appellant's representative. They basically had completely separate interests from the appellant and almost adverse. They're representing the bankruptcy trustee, and it's almost an ethical issue to say you represent a bankruptcy trustee and the appellant. Yes, he should have conducted discovery, but he wasn't
representing. Is it your view that the appellant was therefore did not have representation until the time you came into the case?
Yeah, well, not me personally, but until he got counsel, which took some time, and he wasn't notified that they were abandoning the case until 6 days before the response to the summary judgment was due. He was pro se at that point, was in bankruptcy, had no ability to obtain an attorney. So for the judge to say, you know, I'm just going to grant this motion, you're not going to have any opportunity to get an attorney, I'm not going to stay a brief period of time for you to get an attorney, and let him file a motion to conduct discovery, in our view, was procedurally improper. Similarly, with the motion for summary judgment that was filed on the appeal of 2022-1231, in that case, there was, again, no discovery conducted. The attorney was hired after the summary judgment motion was filed in December of 2021. The judge did not allow any discovery. He made factual findings on the summary judgment motion.
Give us your best shot. I mean, you've got a bunch of arguments as to why summary judgment was not appropriate here. You know, we hear these cases all the time. I mean, you can always come up with some potential factual dispute, but it has to be important. And so give us, you raise a lot of different issues. Give us your best shot. Pick the top two.
I guess the one, I think, to me, our position is that the biggest one is there was no discovery conducted. How can you grant, I mean, there should be a deferential standard if no discovery has been conducted, rather than picking at the...
Well, give us an example of in what respect, what discovery was necessary that had not been conducted.
No depositions were conducted. The initial counsel had indicated she was going to conduct 10 to 12 depositions, third-party depositions, third-party discovery. None of that was done because it was not allowed.
Well, there were depositions of four SSA employees.
Yeah, government deposition. But, you know, we're representing the appellant, and we were not able to conduct any discovery. I mean, yeah, they were able to conduct discovery that further bolstered their summary judgment motion, but that left us, again, without any recourse other than trying to pick through the record and find additional facts.
I'm persuaded to some extent by your argument that the bankruptcy estate's conduct should not be imputed to your client because they really didn't represent your interests. But the problem is, as I understand the facts, the bankruptcy counsel informed your client on July 1st that it intended to abandon all of these appeals and was not going to pursue anything. You had from, unless I'm mistaken, July 1st until July 19th, and of course I don't mean you because you weren't involved in the case yet at that point, but your client was on notice from July 1st to July 19th, during which time they just undertook no actions, and they could have. So why isn't that behavior sufficient to have us sort of lose sympathy for the fact that they didn't have an obligation to conduct discovery when, in fact, from July 1st to July 19th, they knew the appeals were being abandoned by the bankruptcy trustee, and they did nothing to further their own case?
3 points on that. Number one, at that point, on the July...
Am I right about the facts, the timing and stuff? Is that... Do I have that
correct,
right?
But just to clarify a little bit of the facts to you. July 1st, an email was sent to the counsel that had already withdrawn from the case. It wasn't sent to the appellant saying, I know you're not represented by counsel. They sent it to the bankruptcy trustee attorney, sent an email to the counsel that had withdrawn in the case saying, we're returning this to you to deal with.
The counsel had already formally withdrawn.
Withdrawn and it was approved. So there was no counsel in the case. There was no, it was improper to notify them as the no longer attorney of record for the appellant. The appellant was just copied on that message. then 60.
Wait, but appellant was copied on the message?
Yeah, but it's a pro se individual. He doesn't know the ins and outs of litigation and whatnot. Third, he's in bankruptcy at that point. So 3 weeks or less than 3 weeks before a summary judgment motion responses to be filed in a very complicated case, he's expected to, in bankruptcy, find a counsel who's willing to take on that case with the prospect of not being paid and file a response to a summary judgment motion.
Yeah, but unfortunately, that's probably the circumstances in many cases. I mean, guy's getting hit with this stuff. He doesn't have a lawyer. He's got to either get a lawyer or decide he's going to represent himself and do the best that he can, and there might be leeway if he's representing himself. But none of that, I don't think, necessarily obviates the responsibility he has, lawyer or no lawyer, to proceed to represent himself if he wants to adjudicate the claim.
And normally, in our experience with judges like that, and when a pro se individual is in a circumstance where they've just gotten out of bankruptcy, their prior counsel has withdrawn, there's a motion for summary judgment pending.
Well, did he ask for a stay? Did he come in and say, look, I'm trying to find a lawyer, I need a lawyer, I want a lawyer, and I just need 3 weeks to try to obtain counsel. Can you give me that time to do that? Was that sort of request made?
He is pro se. No, he did not do that. Customarily, a court would address that to a pro se individual saying, this is pending, I'll give you some time to get counsel. In order to file, but this is the only amount of time I'm going to give you. They don't just grant the motion with a two-paragraph summary decision without explaining it to the person.
Before your time runs out, can I just ask you to talk a little about, I know your main answer is we didn't get discovery, so we weren't in a position to be able to defeat summary judgment. But it seems to me some of the allegations you make as to the impropriety of summary judgment, I think the facts are there. We know what the facts are, right? One of the arguments is that you expected more work, more contracts, and you got fewer.
Right.
I don't think there's a factual dispute about that, but it doesn't lead one to conclude that that was an excuse for you not doing the work on the contracts you had because your expectation was you'd get more. So some of these summary judgment issues fall out, discovery or no discovery, right?
Yeah, some of them are. Our position for the eight that we identified, they don't fall out. And for example, just give you one example, non-payment of invoices, that's recognized as an excusable delay. If you're financially squeezing a company so they can't perform, that's a recognized basis for overturning a termination for default. That happened in this case, but we weren't able to even just conduct discovery on that particular issue.
Was there a dispute as to whether or not the invoices were paid, or
no? It was just delay in payment, which is a recognized way to squeeze a company and not allow them to perform properly on a contract. I only have 2 minutes remaining, so I'll cede the rest of my time.
We'll restore some of your rebuttal time. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kirshner, am I saying that right?
You are.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Kirshner.
Good morning, and may it please the court. In both of the cases today before you, CGS portrays itself as a passive victim of circumstance who lost the appeals before the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals, or the CBCA, through no fault of its own. But the record in both of these cases demonstrates that cannot be farther from the truth. In the three representative cases before the board, which are the subject of the first appeal before you, the 21-2035 appeal, CGS had an opportunity to conduct discovery for an entire year, from the end of 2018 when they filed the board appeals to the end of 2019.
But what's the play between CGS and their trustees' attorney? So they were there. Are you lumping them in one, or are you saying separately he had an opportunity?
Separately, Your Honor. So
was it before they went into bankruptcy?
Before they went into bankruptcy, that's right. So CGS filed a voluntary petition for Chapter 7 bankruptcy in December of 2019. By then, their appeals before the board had been pending for an entire year, and their counsel of choice, Mr. Bush, had a year to conduct discovery, and he did. He served interrogatories, he served document requests, he subpoenaed documents from a third party. He did all that during that 1 year. He just was unable to substantiate the allegations that eventually were made on summary judgment.
Because we have a number of cases here. which of the cases is the one exactly in which he had that year to serve discovery and did serve discovery?
So that relates to the three representative matters before the board, Your Honor. It is the...
So all the appeals in front of us right now?
The ones that we lost for jurisdictional reasons.
Right? That's right. The ones that are lost for jurisdiction. Okay. So I'll give you a little bit of background. There is 18 total cases before the board. Those were split up. The board asked CGS to pick three representative matters.
Right.
And CGS did that. They picked the Detroit-Michigan contract, board appeal number 6264, the Tallahassee-Florida contract, board appeal number 6279, and the Dallas-Texas contract.
And all three were kicked for jurisdiction.
All three, well, they were not kicked for jurisdiction.
I'm sorry, you're right. Summary judgment, right? Just granted against them on all
an
three.
Unopposed motion.
And the question is whether we have jurisdiction.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yes.
That's the first matter before you. That's
and when the unopposed motion for summary judgment was granted, was he individually represented, or was it just the trustee's attorney that was representing the other side?
So by the time the unopposed motion for summary judgment was granted, which was in December of 2020, by then the bankruptcy trustee had abandoned all board appeals, and they were no longer a part of the bankruptcy estate. And I believe at that time CGS was already represented by successor counsel of their choosing. But again, going back to those representative cases, so from November of 2018 when they filed the board appeals to December of 2019 when CGS voluntary petitioned for Chapter 7 bankruptcy, there was a year in which they could conduct discovery. They did so. They just did not substantiate their allegations. Now, the next thing that CGS did is it voluntarily...
You say they did not substantiate their allegations. There was no determination of that.
Well, there was no determination of that, but in response to the...
How do we know? For all I know, they had a ton of really good discovery that they obtained that would have substantiated their allegations. It's just that they didn't have counsel who properly filed a response to the summary judgment motion.
That's true for the representative matters. But they could have used those discovery responses if they had gotten those really good responses that showed the agency committed excusable delay under FAR 52.212-4. They could have used that discovery in response to the motion for summary judgment in the remaining 15 cases, to which they did respond. But they didn't do that. Now, I want the court... to not give them a free pass for the bankruptcy proceeding. Because while it is true, and I think you mentioned that, Chief Judge Moore, that you understand their position, that they were not represented, strictly speaking, by the attorney.
Well, in fact, the trustee has sort of competing obligations and interests that he has to represent, he or she. So the trustee is not there purely as their representative. And if the bankruptcy obligations that he has to the creditors exceed, or more important than whatever he has to do to preserve these cases, then he's got to make a call. He's not there purely to preserve their interests.
So that is true, but that is a natural function of filing a voluntary petition for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. The bankruptcy code provides that that is exactly what happens. Once a
what have other courts held with regard to this? Have other courts suggested that events like this that occur during bankruptcy are or are not attributed to the party who filed bankruptcy?
We haven't seen anything specific to the scenario we have before you.
There have to be cases out there in which a bankruptcy trustee didn't do something that would have protected or preserved the interests of the bankruptcy claimant, and there has to be questions. Did you just not look beyond sort of the law that's most relevant to this case to see if there's anything analogous in Delaware, for example, or somewhere else where they're looking at what should be attributed to the bankruptcy trustee and not attributed to the bankruptcy trustee?
We haven't seen anything quite that specific, Your Honor, but I'll say that CGS.
Are you saying that if the bankruptcy trustee hasn't performed properly, there are ways to challenge the trustee on a breach of fiduciary duty basis. But this isn't alleged here. The bankruptcy trustee was arguably determining what's in the best interest of the bankrupt estate, and in his or her determination, it made no sense to keep the case going.
That's exactly right. And there may be an opportunity to challenge what the bankruptcy trustee decides, perhaps in a bankruptcy court proceeding.
Was it clear to the other side that, I mean, one would assume that he would understand what his rights were vis-a-vis the bankruptcy attorney. And so was it an expectation or understood that maybe he ought to get his own lawyer and represent his own interests and that he failed to do that? Or do you think he was kind of hoodwinked and thinking, like, well, these guys have my back and I don't have to do anything and they're just going to take care of me?
So I'm not sure what the appellant understood. That perhaps is a better question for my friend on the other side. But what I can tell you is that the bankruptcy code is clear that once a corporation that initiates civil litigation against someone else files a voluntary petition for Chapter 7 bankruptcy, the debtor's litigation becomes property of the bankruptcy estate, and that debtor loses all control over that ongoing litigation.
Okay, so going back to what he started with, which is on these other 15 contracts. So he's out there, he ultimately gets his own lawyer to represent his interests. And then why not give him discovery? There's a new lawyer in. Up until now, it's been really the bankruptcy interests that have been protected and not his. So it seems like his main argument with respect to the 15 remaining claims is that he wasn't given enough a fair opportunity for discovery. So can you respond to that?
Sure. And my response is really in two parts. The first one is that CGS had an opportunity to conduct discovery on the 15 remaining appeals because the SSA granted the government's motion for summary judgment on the representative appeals, the three appeals, in August of 2020, and the SSA did not move for summary judgment on the remaining appeals until December of 2020. That was a 3.5-month period in which CGS could have either conducted any additional discovery it saw fit or asked the board to have more time to conduct additional discovery, asked for a stay. It could have done a number of things, but during that 3.5-month period, it did absolutely nothing. And we don't think that's...
And were they represented at that time?
They were represented for part of that time, absolutely. I believe in October of 2020, they got represented by their current attorney. So that's my first response. My second response is that you have to remember that the standard of review for a request for additional discovery under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 56D is abuse of discretion, which is a very high bar for overturning a trial-level court. So even if this court looks at the evidence before it and thinks to itself, well, if we were sitting as a trial court, perhaps we would have given CGF the benefit of the doubt and given them some additional time to conduct discovery. That is not a reason to overturn the board's decision. The board's decision can only be overturned if they made a clear error of law or a clear error of fact. And based on the entire record.
No, it's not a clear error of law. It's an error of law.
I'm sorry.
The abuse of discretion standard is an error of law, which means de novo review on the legal questions.
That's right. An error of law or a clear error of fact.
Okay. Can I ask you to put your pen down? It's a bit distracting.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You keep waving it around at us.
I apologize.
That's okay. I want to turn back to jurisdiction, though, because the government argues that we don't have jurisdiction. And I'm not certain that that's accurate in light of Torres. Would you address the government's position on, are you arguing we don't have jurisdiction or that we shouldn't exercise jurisdiction? Because I think there's no doubt that at a minimum we have the ability here to choose not to exercise jurisdiction under these circumstances. What's the government's position? Is it black letter we don't have jurisdiction? Or is it, okay, under Torres, you may have jurisdiction, but we don't think you should because of all of these facts, exercise it?
So we are arguing that the court does not have jurisdiction and may not exercise any discretion in reviewing these cases. So there's no question here that there's a jurisdictional 120-day period within which an appellant may appeal a decision from a Board of Contract Appeals.
Well, but Rule 4D allows for an improper filing, right, to be imputed to for jurisdictional purposes, doesn't it?
So Rule 4D of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, I'm assuming, Your Honor, not the Federal Circuit rules, is a very specific rule that talks about appeals that were misfiled in an appellate court when they were actually supposed to be filed in a district court. And as we explained, there is a statutory provision that supplies the appellate court the ability to transfer. 1631.
Yeah.
That provision does not apply to appeals misfiled in a Board of Contract Appeals.
What about Torres? What about the decision in Torres? Does that open the door to an improper filing, nonetheless being deemed, even though it's not technically compliant, as compliant?
We don't think so, Your Honor. So Torres involved Rule 3C of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, which includes a specificity requirement. It says that all appellants must be specifically noted on the notice of appeal. And in Torres, the Supreme Court held that that specificity requirement in Rule 3C is jurisdictional in nature, and a failure to comply with that specificity requirement requires dismissal without any discretion, regardless of the circumstances of the case. And we think that in the same way that a failure to comply with the specificity requirement in Rule 3C would vitiate, as the Supreme Court put it, statutory deadlines, failure to comply with Rule 15 and the procedure set out there for filing an appeal of an agency decision would also vitiate the statutory deadline for doing so.
So we think Federal Circuit Rule 15A2 is what governs, and we have no jurisdiction. 15A2.
Yes, I would only note that there's two rules that really govern here. There's Federal Circuit Rule 15A2A.
A2A.
But there is also Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 15A1. They're companion rules, in a way, because they both provide that in any appeal from an agency decision, that appeal has to be filed with the clerk of the appropriate appellate court. So in filing a notice of appeal with the board, which is what CGS did within the 120-day deadline, CGS failed to comply with both of those rules.
And trap 4D is the opposite facts, where someone mistakenly files here.
That's right, but again, it only applies to transfers among courts, right, between an appellate court and a district court, which is permitted by 28 U.S.C. Section 1631. There is no corollary statutory provision that allows transfers between courts and administrative tribunals.
Did you hear the line of questioning that I had with opposing counsel about the concerns I had about broadening the exception that permits transfer? I just don't know where the line would stop. You know, this is the Board of Contract Appeals is an Article I tribunal. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so if filing in a non-Article III court would suddenly satisfy a jurisdictional requirement for an Article III court, I just became concerned about where the line would be drawn in terms of satisfying filing requirements. Does the government have that same concern?
Absolutely. We agree 100%, Your Honor, because if notice to the agency becomes the standard, whenever the agency gets notice, then you can imagine a whole host of other scenarios where an appellant would do something else and then come to the court for relief just because they provided notice to the agency. For instance, what if the next time an appellant wants to appeal a decision of, let's say, the CBCA, just like here, but instead of filing a petition for review with the clerk, they email in an unofficial email someone at the clerk's office instead of filing a notice on the ECF system. Would that be enough to file within the confines of Rule 15 just because they provided notice to the agency? Or what if they're trying to appeal a CBCA decision, but instead of filing a notice of appeal with the CBCA, which on its own would not be proper, they filed a notice of appeal with the Armed Services Board of Contract Appeals, a different board, because they made another mistake and they confused it with another case they had before the ASBCA.
If we agree with you on the jurisdictional question, either of the two ways, that it's mandatory and we have no jurisdiction, or even if it's at our discretion, we shouldn't exercise jurisdiction. In either of those scenarios, we're ultimately agreeing with what you want for jurisdiction. Does that just end the case in its entirety, all of the matters currently before us?
No, Your Honor, not quite. So that would end The first appeal, the 21-2035 appeal that relates to the three representative matters, it would not end the second appeal, the 22-1231 appeal, because in that appeal, CGS did timely petition for review of the board's second summary judgment decision. Okay.
So with respect to those 15 contracts, we will have to decide whether or not the grant of summary judgment was proper.
You would have to decide that. That's correct, Your Honor. So you're
saying the case with the three appeals should be dismissed.
That's right.
And the other should be affirmed.
That's correct. That's correct, Judge Lord.
Because there's no proof of excusable neglect.
Because there is no proof of excusable, well, there's no proof of excusable delays, which is the provision within FAR 52.212-4, which was incorporated into the 15 contracts, that allows conversion of a termination for default to a termination for convenience. The problem that CGS faces is that in the 15 remaining board appeals, they offered these 8 implied duties of good faith and fair dealing, and they suggested to the board that the SSA violated these implied duties. But the problem is that they didn't provide any contractual hook. They didn't provide any anchor within the contract that brings up these implied duties. And so what they essentially try to do is they try to use this amorphous concept of implied duties of good faith and fair dealing to fabricate brand new extra contractual requirements and then apply those requirements to the government.
Well, one of the allegations, for example, is that they said that the SSA employees were unwelcoming to them. There could be a situation, could there not, however, where that conduct would rise to the level so that it would be a breach of an implied duty of good faith and therefore constitute excusable neglect? I mean, that's a theory that's sound as a legal matter, right?
There could potentially be. It really depends on the facts, which the board never got to. But it can only be breach of an implied
duty. Well, that's not a good thing for you to say when we're on summary judgment. I mean, so they never got to it. Why? Because there was no discovery and there were no facts presented?
No, Your Honor. They never got to it because CGS simply said that SSA employees were not welcoming to CGS employees. They never provided a contractual anchor. They never identified a contract obligation that brings up this implied duty of good faith and fair deal. In Dobbins, this court said most clearly, it said so before Dobbins as well, but in Dobbins it said most clearly that if a contractor tries to create new extra contractual requirements through the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing without tethering those to a specific contractual obligation, that's not something that they can prevail on. And that's exactly what CGS did here. I do want to note that in their reply brief before this court, they, for the first time, tried to identify some contractual obligations, some provisions within the contract that would be implicated by these implied duties. But, again, the problem here is they did not do that below. And if you look at pages 493 to 522 of the joint appendix in the second matter, it reproduces in its entirety CGS's response to the motion for summary judgment. There is no mention of any contract terms in that response. So they didn't do that below, and they didn't do that in their opening brief before this court. And so we did not have an opportunity to address those. And so to the extent the court would like to credit their citation to contractual provisions, those are now twice forfeited.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kernan, you have some rebuttal time?
Thank you.
Your Honor, with respect to the timeline that counsel had... Oh, sorry.
That's all right. It's easier to hear you without it.
With respect to the timeline that counsel has presented with regard to the retaining new counsel was retained in December of 2020, shortly before the response to the motion for summary judgment.
But is counsel correct that there was an entire period of time during which active discovery was conducted?
No, it was not a year time that active discovery was conducted. In December of 2019, the original counsel notified the board that the appellant had filed bankruptcy, and
yes, but how long did it have to file and conduct discovery?
I don't have the original document date before me, but all I know is that December 2019 was the date that the notification was that they went into bankruptcy.
Well, the government suggests that they did have time and, in fact, did conduct discovery during that time.
They propounded written interrogatories, but no depositions were taken by the appellant. So we were in.
Did they notice depositions?
No, they did not at that time. So, as you know, with the discovery process, there's normal processes: written discovery. You get responses to written discovery. You formulate your case based on the written discovery responses, and then tactically take depositions. At that point, they were at the point to tactically take depositions, and the bankruptcy was filed. So the key point in discovery, the deposition process, was the appellant was in the bankruptcy proceeding where they had no counsel. And despite what Appellee says that the bankruptcy trustee was representing her interests, obviously from the conduct we know that he was not representing the appellant's interests. The appellant had no reason to know that they weren't representing their interests and not conducting discovery.
What are the consequences of your prevailing here in terms of the discontract dispute, just generally?
Well, we requested two forms of relief, conversion of the, as you know, conversion of termination for default for termination convenient, and then three.
Which would mean the government would be on the hook for the non-paid funds. Is that the consequence?
Termination for convenient costs, so whatever costs they incurred in attempting to perform a contract, attorney's fees, and any other costs. And those are the three forms of relief that were requested before the board. And at this point, and one of our arguments is, we never requested a sum certain, so the board shouldn't even have jurisdiction in the cases in the first place because it was never presented to the contracting officer to request a sum certain. And that's something that should have been done properly before the board. And with respect to the jurisdictional argument that on the case 2021-2035 that the court does not have jurisdiction, I'd just like to highlight the quote from the Foreman decision, which says, the requirements of the rules of procedure should be liberally construed and mere technicality should not stand in the way of consideration of appeal on the merits. So we did file with the board. It is the court, original court in this case. It's not just any random government agency or another board, you know, that appellee says we could have filed with another board. We have specific facts here where we filed with the original court of jurisdiction. It was within 120 days. All the parties were notified. Facts that they should not be.
I've always had trouble with what mere technicalities mean. I mean, it seems like when you're talking about filing deadlines, where you file, one could construe those as being mere technicalities, but those are the bread and butter and sum and substance of all these rules, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And our position is, though, jurisdictionally, the requirement is 120 days. You have 120 days to file. With respect to the process for filing, whether it should be filed with the Court of Appeals, Court of Federal Claims, the board, those technicalities are not jurisdictional, and the board has discretion whether or not to allow those technicalities to prevail.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We've heard from both counsel, and these cases are taken under submission.